Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. It's Thursday edition on 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on today's program, you remember Rio? They had the Olympics. There's bad things going on there. The Olympic Village and all that falling apart. It is a warning for other nations. Also, artifacts found in Jerusalem. Who is protecting the kids in the UK? And today is the 40th anniversary of Star Wars. That and more coming up on this Thursday edition of Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG and kpcg.fm.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. We'd like for you to follow us, but it's your choice. You can do that on Twitter at kpcgfm. We don't force anyone. We're just asking kindly. And email us, comments at kpcg.fm. We're happy to take a look at those for you. Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blondeau here today. We'll start out with the most important news of the day, which is we've concluded Grant's future baby name poll. And Abraham, you've been conducting this scientific poll, I guess we'd call it. People's opinions, Grant, here, of course. Our beloved Grant is going to have a child soon. And so the names are in question. And so we wanted to see what people thought, and a lot of listeners responded.
Yeah, this was a very authoritative, scientifically accurate poll. And the people who responded and voted gave you a smorgasbord of choices to choose from, Grant. So
is one of the names smorgasbord?
I wish.
That would have been great.
Yeah. So the starting with the poll, the four choices, two boy, two girl names, the most popular ones of 2017. Noah, Liam, and then for the girls, Emma and Olivia.
Oh, I like Emma. I like that name.
Yeah. The grand winner is Liam at 47%. Emma is in second with 27%. Noah at 15%. And Olivia comes in last at 11%. So that's just who voted. Now there's plenty of responses, and I'm sure you're going to love some of these names. So Chris Eames said he should take a leaf out of the UK's top boy names list and call it Muhammad. So
noted.
Yeah. And then your own mother replied with her opinion. please don't be mad at me if I say this name wrong. Jicy.
Yeah,
after your great grandma Flurry.
Oh wow, that's an interesting name.
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever heard that before.
Yeah, neither have I. So anyway, that's what your mom is voting for. Someone said, I guess that depends on the gender, and they didn't give a name.
Very true, yes. Good point.
And then Alex Field, he says, if it's a girl, Lily, beautiful flower name. If it's a boy, Muhammad. Just kidding. Liam is a good one.
Wow. Well, you're getting a lot of the the Muhammads here.
You're going to have to go with that one then.
Got to listen to the people.
Yeah. Logan Yoder says, definitely Logan. AJ says Tobias.
Nice.
Monica and Lucas said Jalen Wayne, if it's a boy. Annabelle Rose, if it's a girl. And then one last idea here from SOZ. Joshua Caleb or Jennifer Rose. So nice. Those are the choices. And one other person said that she prefers unique names instead of the common ones to choose from. So anyway, that's what the people said.
You certainly got a lot of responses there. That's great.
Grant and I share the same middle name, David. That's we should do that. Mm-hmm. So anyway, well, thanks for the input, people. That's people. Thanks for the input, people.
You people.
So that's coming up pretty soon, I guess. So we'll see what happens.
July 5th is the due date. So that's pretty soon.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. There'll be some fireworks of some variety. Of course, last summer was the Summer Olympics at Rio. I think everybody remembers that. Leading up to the Olympics, people were somewhat concerned about Rio for a variety of reasons, including, you know, sewage and such. And so they had the Olympics, and it looks nice on television, and people move on. You forget about it, and you tend to think, I suppose, oh, that was a success. Well, not really. The story title is Rio's Example, Why No City Should Bid to Host the Olympics. That doesn't sound good moving forward, does it?
Wow, what a horrible outlook there. What are we going to do if no city bids to host the Olympics?
Yeah, they say just 7 months after the torch was doused, the host country is already acknowledging the entire operation was a terrible, perhaps criminal idea. It has left them debt-ridden, and without a clue what to do with already decaying facilities. So they come in there and they build these huge facilities for the Olympics. What are they going to do with them? There's nothing to do with them, so they're falling apart. The stadiums are falling apart. The golf course is overrun. The housing hasn't been transformed to help the poor, which I guess is what they were saying they were going to do. There's overwhelming debt and no way to recoup it. Even the medals handed out in Rio are falling apart. There's another headline saying dozens of eco-friendly, sustainable Rio Olympics medals return because of rust and decay. Well, that's what happens when they're eco-friendly. They decay.
I heard recently about one of the past Olympic sites, maybe it was South Africa or Russia, where they built all these stadiums basically just for, actually it was Cuba. I think they had it 1 year, a long time ago maybe. And, they built a lot of at least stadiums for some huge event, and they're already all falling apart just because you have so many stadiums in one place, you can't really use them all regularly,
sure,
except for during that one huge event.
Yep.
And if you're not using the building, that seems to be what happens. It starts to decay.
It costs a lot of money for upkeep. It's not just a one-time deal. And they say, meanwhile, the water is still polluted. So that they have that going for them. Or not going for them, I guess, in this case. The next three games are set, Pyeongchang in South Korea in 2016, Tokyo 2020, Beijing 2022. No takers after that. So basically what they're saying is it's very hard for them to have the Olympics in a country that isn't already pretty affluent, to where maybe you just kind of update something or you build one thing. But they're already affluent. You go into an impoverished nation and you try to build this infrastructure, and then you just leave. Well, it's just sitting there. They don't have anything to do with it. It falls apart. They have debt. It's a bad deal.
Yeah, even affluent nations have problems with the Olympics, either going into debt themselves or or the same thing. I mean, the in Montreal, the Olympic Stadium, where they would have football and baseball, and when the Expos were still there, when the Alouettes played there for the CFL, in case people didn't know there's a Canadian Football League.
That would be actually a great another name for Grant to consider, Alouette.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
Just throwing it out there.
But basically pieces of the roof are falling off during the seasons. It's because it just decays. It's old, and they don't have the money to keep refurbishing it and all that stuff. So same thing in Calgary. When I lived there, all the stuff from the Winter Olympics there is pretty much just a landmark. It's not used anymore. So even first world countries struggle with the Olympics, funding it and doing everything. So I know they want to go to other nations because it is a boost to the economy and it's showcasing the world and all that kind of thing. But there is a reality, and I think it did take a little bit of courage probably from the officials in Brazil to acknowledge the reality of it and not try to cover it up or push it to the side. Because
I think they're angry.
Yeah.
Is what it is. You know, I think they're just furious about it. And it's always amazing to me when they don't give out gold medals. I'm not exactly sure what they gave out in Rio. I don't know what it means to have these sustainable medals. But I remember a few years back, they were basically glass and they had little gold flakes on them or something. Are we that hard up for gold? Aren't they selling it all the time on TV? Can you not make just a solid gold medal? Wouldn't you be furious if you won an Olympic event? You're the best in the world, and they can't even give you a gold medal?
Yes.
That's outrageous to me.
It seems like anyone could buy gold off TV, like you said, and it would be a huge windfall for any of those companies to sponsor the Olympics by producing the medals. That would be a huge business move for any of them, so it shouldn't be that hard to come up with some gold for the medals.
Give them a gold medal. Why is it so hard? I was thinking, Winter Olympics, what they should do is build all the facilities out of ice and snow.
That's true.
It's over with. It melts.
That's what they do in Quebec every year at the Winter Festival. They everything's made of snow, like the snow sculptures, ice sculptures, snow castles. And then they're gone.
Summer Olympics, do it on the beach. Build it out of sand.
Yeah.
No problem. Goes back to nature. Yeah. But even, you know, if you look here in the United States where there's a lot of money in these sports leagues, why do teams jump around city to city? It's always because they want a new stadium.
Right.
Because after, even if you're keeping it up after, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 years, they need a new facility. And so that's why, like, the Raiders are going to Vegas because they want a new facility and to gamble. But so even in a first world country where there's just a boatload of money being shoved at those sports, stadiums fall apart. Well, you know, if you don't, so that just shows that obviously if you don't have a professional sport playing there or anybody willing to take on the expense of keeping it up, it's just going to be a big ruin. So I can see why that happens.
Would there be a problem with hosting the Olympics in America, just nationwide at all the big cities, because there's so many of them in this country, you could pretty much spread the events out all over the map, and I don't think we'd have too many problems with infrastructure if it were more spread out as well.
Yeah, we've had a few here recently. I was trying to think.
Like Chicago, I think, was one of them. Was, L.A., maybe.
L.A. was in 84, one. Right? And then, yeah. Of course, after that, it was in, where was it? It was down in, Florida area. I can't remember exactly where it was. Atlanta.
Yeah,
it was in Atlanta, Georgia. I don't know if we've had one since then.
Like Salt Lake City.
Salt Lake City, yeah.
Yeah, 2002.
Yeah, that's the most recent, I guess.
Yeah.
So nobody wants to bring it back to the States. The world's out to get us. They want to put it in these, like, third world countries, but this is what you get.
They should bring it to Nebraska. So when you're driving in through there, it's beautiful, and then all of a sudden there's this huge multi-million-dollar sports complex.
Field of Dreams.
Yeah.
You think, hey, you're a great athlete. Try to get through this corn maze.
Yeah, put the events in the heartland. We're not elitist.
Yeah, just do it like, you know, the kids do it on the farm. You just kind of draw your little your ball diamond, play on that thing. This might make you nervous. The U.S. Army lost track of $1 billion worth of weapons and equipment. Where did I put that? Where did that go? The unaccounted for military supplies were supposed to be given to Iraqi armed forces as part of the Iraq Train and Equip Fund, but they don't know where they are. Any guesses? You think ISIS might have them?
I did see a video a few months ago where it showed the Syrian army driving U.S. equipment, and they were trying to figure out where they got it from. And so I think what probably happened is they shipped the weapons and the vehicles and all that stuff over there, and then it got captured by ISIS or someone else, and they don't want to tell everyone what happened. And then they're just selling it or giving it away to their allies, or something like that. But it just seems like it's probably in the hands of the enemy, or else the U.S. government probably knows where it is. They just don't want to say.
If it was actually lost, can you imagine the email chain? You know how it is in a regular office. If somebody misplaces the stapler, you're going to have 10 emails about it, right?
Yeah.
Where's that $1 billion worth of military equipment? Forwarded to, you know, 7 people. Anyone seen this?
Are we even sure that the equipment exists, or was this some sort of, you know, money laundering scheme for the military? Hopefully not.
Yeah, I don't know. They don't give a lot of details other than the fact that they say they don't know where it is and it was supposed to go to Iraq. So who knows? It'll probably pop up in other war zones. You do see that happen from time to time. New study's out, kind of interesting, from studyfinds.org. If you're terrified of snakes, be more afraid. Thought to be loners, they say, snakes coordinate hunts together. Apparently they have a plan. That's what they're claiming anyway. They notice the Cuban boa. They go into these caves. They're ideal spots to catch prey. And what they do is they hang from the roof of the cave when the bats fly back in and they eat them. You imagine going into that cave. You know, look out for the bats. Look out for the snakes.
That's incredible.
That'd be awesome to see those. Yeah. Ever could capture on video. And it's pretty ingenious how there's always something to above something in the food chain.
Yeah.
Somehow, and they always have these ingenious ways of doing it.
Yeah, so they observe them going at night and at at dawn, you know, when I guess the bats would be coming and going, hanging there, and then they just eat them out of the air. The bats, of course, don't figure it out. They just keep flying. They say what they've observed is that they would all these Cuban boas would hang together and kind of form like a wall, so they had a better chance of grabbing one of the bats. So, yeah, pretty fascinating and horrifying at the same time. So apparently they, you know, I don't know if they're planning it out. They probably just instinct tells them, hey, go up there and hang off the ceiling, and they all hang in the same spot. So, but it is interesting, and I didn't know that these snakes would do that. But interesting study.
Yeah, I guess I've seen, every time I've seen snakes, they've pretty much been together, like snakes in a cage or in a pit or on an airplane.
Yes.
Snakes on a plane.
Well, it gives new meaning to the term hanging out. Right. These snakes do hang out.
It's hanging upside down.
Literally.
Blood to the head.
It does remind me, the coolest thing I ever saw talking about animals working together, in Arizona, in the desert, there's a breed of falcon. And they're much smaller, but they hunt in threes and fours. And they actually have a strategy, and they work together to hunt, because it's much harder to catch the small desert rodents because they're better at hiding. And so they'll work together. They'll basically funnel the rodent into a place where it gets cornered. And then each of the birds will take up a spot so it can't escape. It will like basically surround it at different exits if it's under a cacti or whatever. And so they're really intelligent. They're just working together to completely surround their prey until one of them eventually catches it.
Wow. There's a pretty neat video today. It's kind of a scary video on going viral. This hunter in Canada, he's a bow hunter. He's using a bow, and I think he was hunting bear. So that takes, I don't know if he was hunting the bear or hunting something else, but anyway, the bear chases him, runs at him, and you can see it all because he has his GoPro or whatever on his head. And so if you want to see what it looks like to be attacked by a bear, the video's out there. Oh,
that'd be terrifying.
Yeah.
Seeing that 300 pounds of pure muscle and fuzz just charge at you.
Yeah, I mean, you see it come at him, and you can hear the sounds and everything, and it knocks him over. Nothing happens for a moment, and then the guy just gets up and says, like, oh, I should have killed it earlier or something. I guess it just ran away. So he wasn't harmed other than being scared and maybe a little bruised. Pretty epic story and video, though.
Yeah, the most epic hunting story I've ever heard, though, is someone else told me this. I guess in the Amazon, they would hunt jaguars. And the guy, he's a European. He used to use a gun, but then the tribes down there showed him to use this really long spear, because the jaguars attack you from the front and they use the same pattern. And so with the spear, you can get them while they jump. But if you miss, you're dead. But he never made a mistake, but he would hunt jaguars just with a 20-foot spear.
Yeah.
And that's the most terrifying thing I've ever seen, a jaguar attack and pounce, like their power and their speed. And you have to get that spear just right to get it while it's jumping at you. So that's just insane.
That sounds like a flaw in the jaguar's attack plan, to have a huge leap like that. When they're flying through the air, that's when they're most vulnerable. They could just charge into you. They're so fast, they wouldn't need to really leap for it.
You'd have to have nerves of steel to stand there and wait on it. Sometimes we have a hard time with some of the kids we have on our little league team staying in the box when the ball's coming. Mm-hmm. Maybe that'd be a way to train them.
Yeah.
You stand here at this jaguar coming at you. You won't be afraid of the baseballs anymore. They found some interesting relics in Jerusalem. They're always finding things over there. FoxNews.com says 2,000-year-old battle relics provide evidence of the last battle of Jerusalem. They have found, this thing's about 2,000 years ago, according to the Israel Antiquities Authority. Included in the dig's findings are arrowheads and stone ballista balls, which were discovered on the main street that ascended from the city's gates and the pool of Siloam to the temple. And so they think this was the battle 2,000 years ago in Jerusalem. They found some relics from it. Pretty fascinating.
Yeah, it's in some cities there, especially the one I went to was Lachish, which is where Sennacherib conquered, and he has the big wall reliefs there at the British Museum. They've only excavated a small portion of the tell, or where the city is, but there are so many arrowheads there. There's probably millions of little arrowheads, but they don't want you to take them because I think it breaks the law over there to take an artifact. But there's so many arrowheads, and they've only excavated a very small part because that's just where the Assyrians were just launching ballistics into the city all the time. So in Jerusalem, that'd be really fascinating to see if they can. I assume this is talking about the Roman attack
yes.
in 70 AD or so.
Right. They say the battle which pitted the Romans and the Jewish rebels was described by the historian Flavius Josephus. And he said, wrote, on the following day, the Romans, having routed the brigands from the town, set the whole on fire as far as Salome. That's in Josephus Wars, Book 6363. And so they think it's from that battle. So it's very interesting. But again, there's always a controversy, right? How long were the Jews there? Johnny come lately? not according to what they keep finding.
Yeah, well, they have artifacts going back even further, not to 2000 BC. Yeah. Never mind around 0 AD or 70 AD with these. So I mean, that goes back to where all the formative period when the Babylonians and the Assyrians were just becoming nations, that sort of thing. So they're one of the oldest nations on earth, like oldest nation states on earth, and there's no way you can deny that. And there's enough proof from other historical evidence from other nations, and then just what they find on the ground, that they're one of the oldest kingdoms in the world.
Yeah, it's really amazing. We have, of course, Abraham, you've been over there on the archaeological dig that Herbert W. Armstrong College students go on from time to time. That's where we're broadcasting from, the campus. And, of course, Brent Nautical has a program on this station, Watch Jerusalem, that's on Sundays. And he's right over there. And so he's heavily involved in a lot of the digs and so forth. So make sure you listen for that and check out that website on Watch Jerusalem as well. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And we're online, too, at kpcg.fm. Live link at thetrumpet.com. Make sure you listen for the Key of David program coming up here in a bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. Special program today. Definitely don't want to miss this one. Nicholas Frank, he is an author. He is a German. And he recently wrote an article titled "Don't Trust Germany to Stay Democratic If Economy Takes a Downturn," warns Nazi governor's son. He has family history back to the Nazis. And so he says, don't trust Germany if things get a little dicey over there. They talked to him on the Trumpet Daily today. So make sure you listen for that. It was a great interview.
Yeah, and apparently he also believes that there could be a German strongman coming on the scene pretty soon. So they had a lot to talk about, a lot of common ground in that interview. Pretty exciting to hear that from a German himself who knows the mentality of the people and what they rally around when times get tough.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely somebody that has insight from his personal experience. And what he's saying is not popular. But he's a very credible person. You couldn't find probably somebody historically more credible at this time.
Yeah, that's what makes it so compelling, is that his father worked directly with Hitler. And so he's a lot of credibility and memories of what it was like at that time period. And then also living through the transformation up to today of the German democracy in a modern state. So it is really interesting. And I think it's something that we need to consider when we thinking about how Germany represents themselves, is that there was one key phrase he used during the interview, and that was a silent majority. And we're used to that meaning something else in the States, but what it means in Germany is that the politicians, the academics will say one thing, but the people feel something else, especially with he's talking about the migrant crisis, to where the government can say whatever they want, but there is a consensus in how the normal, everyday German feels about it. And with those emotions coming to the forefront, that's going to that might suddenly decide who the next leader of Germany is.
Yeah. Very interesting interview on the Trumpet Daily Radio Show today. It's coming up here in a bit on KPCG, and you can find the archive online at thetrumpet.com too, and kpcg.fm, so that way a lot of people like to download it and listen to it at a convenient time for them. But it's a great show today. Make sure you listen for that. Also, stop and check out thetrumpet.com. Top story today, Iran election ready for reform question. Also related to that, Iran's next president will be a hardliner and the king of the South. Those are the top stories at thetrumpet.com. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live. Occasionally, in this country, there are lawsuits that seem a bit frivolous. McDonald's, right?
Occasionally?
Every day? Is that occasionally? Well, this one maybe takes the cake. Jelly Belly sued by woman claiming she didn't know jelly beans contained sugar. Let that sink in. A California woman is suing the makers of Jelly Belly jelly beans, claiming she was tricked into believing one of the company's candy products was free of sugar. The plaintiff, who shall remain nameless, of San Bernardino County in California, first brought the case against the candy company earlier this year, blaming "quote unquote" fancy phrasing for confusing her over the ingredients. So that is her lawsuit. Fancy phrasing confused her. One of the comments on the story, the person wrote, "Jelly Belly could have been a clue."
It's not something you want to have to describe your own belly.
If I eat this, what will it do to me?
I'll give you a jelly belly.
It's going to give you a jelly belly. So I don't know that this will get anywhere. I don't think it will, but it just shows you some of the kind of frivolous lawsuits that are out there.
Yeah, well, I'm pretty sure they're under law. They have to list their ingredients, and as long as they put the ingredients on there, they can't be sued. I mean, there's probably 50 kinds of sugar they have to list on there, and they're probably all on the package. And then also, at least from my experience, people want to eat jelly bellies or jelly beans because of the sugar, because they taste sweet.
Right.
I don't know what else gives that kind of taste. It has to be sugar. Like, I don't know what else in this universe tastes like a jelly bean that's not sugar.
Yeah. Give me a plain tasting gelatinous ball. You have one of those?
Maybe she looked at the ingredients and saw words like fructose and glucose and didn't realize that's actually talking about sugar.
That's, I think, probably what the case is. But as another person pointed out astutely, and Abraham, you alluded to this, everything they have on their label is there probably because of lawsuits or to prevent lawsuits.
Exactly.
They don't just randomly write stuff on there. They know they got to cover themselves. So Jelly Belly might have been a clue. I won't ask you guys this question. I don't want you to incriminate yourselves, but occasionally people fall asleep on the job. And this is a write-up of the best excuses for sleeping on the job. In India, after Indian National Congress Vice President Rahul Gandhi was seemingly caught in slumber in Parliament in 2016, a colleague let reporters know he was, in fact, looking down to check his cell phone. That was his excuse. You've seen that. People are in a meeting. You're like, are they sleeping or are they looking down at something? He claimed to be looking at his phone.
I'm not sure that's a better thing to be doing than sleeping during the meeting.
Right. Is the excuse any better? Here's another one. This is funny. We've been kind of talking about some of the humor in Parliament in the UK, and this sort of relates. This is from Australia. Lawmaker Clive Palmer blamed then Prime Minister Tony Abbott for boring him into unconsciousness after being captured by television cameras taking a nap in Parliament in 2014. Why were you sleeping? Well, the speaker bored me into unconsciousness.
At least that's witty, even though it's not really a great excuse.
And maybe it's true.
It's a free shot at the other side.
Yeah.
It does remind me of something Churchill said. There's this older one MP was giving a really boring speech, and there was that one, Churchill was just sitting there, and he was numbing his mind, but he was looking across the aisle, and there's this older man with an ear horn leaning in and trying to listen.
Yeah.
And Churchill leaned over to someone beside him and said, "Who is this fool denying his natural advantages?"
That's great.
You can't hear it. Why try to?
Yeah.
It's not worth hearing.
Yeah, you don't see a lot of ear horns anymore. That's not a common thing. And one other one. This is President Reagan from back in the day. He had a habit of snoozing during overseas events, most notably during a 1982 speech by Pope John Paul II. He blamed it on his inability to sleep on planes. So it can happen to the best and the brightest as well. And then you've got to have an excuse of some kind.
That one's fair and understandable. Getting jet lag, it's almost like your body demands that you go to sleep right now, no matter how inconvenient that might be.
Right. Sometimes it's hard to keep your eyeballs open. I always remember those crazy cartoons when they're trying to fall asleep, and they put the toothpicks in their eyelids and stuff, and it snaps. And
that sounds horrible.
They show you all sorts of things in those cartoons that you're like, you know, you would never do that. You would never stick a toothpick in your eye.
It would just hurt the skin.
Oh, man.
Even if it didn't slip into your eye.
Yeah. Grant, you've got a write-up for us here. This is from the Daily Mail. Katie Hopkins, she's been in some hot water lately over some of her tweeting after the terror attack over there. But she says, the politicians now have hundreds of troops protecting them while telling the rest of us to keep calm and stay united and carry on. Who is going to protect our kids from the terror they let in? She's not holding back.
Yes, and it seems like, from what I've noticed, there has been a lot more anger after this recent attack. Maybe more people waking up to the threat they're facing and just getting tired of family members and friends and really whole cities being undermined by an attack like this. And so people are finally speaking out, and she is a voice for, I'm sure, millions of people over there.
Yeah, I think it probably is because of the what was targeted, which was young girls, teen girls, a very specific attack on, you know, one of the more vulnerable segments of society. And, of course, the parents are going to be outraged by it. So, you know, I even saw one of the 80s pop sensations from over there come out and be strong against terrorism, Morrissey. Mm-hmm. If you know anything about him, he was definitely very liberal, very anti, you know, the royal family and all of that. And now to have him come out and start talking, you know, wow, some people are actually getting upset that normally we're pretty open to a lot of different things.
Yeah, it's finally striking a nerve, which is strange because you would have thought it would have happened a long time ago. But at least people are reacting to it now. This terrorist from this attack in Manchester, actually, it seems like he went over to the Middle East, got radicalized over in Libya. It looks like Libya, and came back because his father and brother were arrested over there in Libya. Salman Abedi was still able to come back, no problem, and commit the attack. And like we've been talking about, he's been on a watch list for a long time. If he's on a watch list and he goes over to Libya, that would really seem to set off a lot of alarm bells and be a big problem there.
Yeah, it's an interesting issue that because he was on the MI5 watch list as long in like a group of 3,000 other people or something like that. But it brings up an interesting issue of due process. How can you arrest someone because you think they're going to attack, even if maybe you don't have enough evidence to prosecute them? It's just a difficult subject because if you do give them powers to that, then the government could maybe start arresting anyone else that they think could be dangerous when they're actually not. So I think that's the fear of giving them too much power. But at the same time, with this man, it seemed like there was plenty of proof. I mean, his father was a member of Al-Qaeda, from what I read. And, I mean, there was no doubt that he was planning or up to something that was devious. So hopefully it will cause a change in British culture. And maybe sometimes shock therapy is the only thing that get people to wake up.
Yeah, I'd be curious to know what the process was for him to get back from Libya, I guess it was. You know, because, you know, it's hard to get back into some countries, like, I don't, maybe many of them, I'm not sure, I haven't traveled around that much, but coming back into the U.S. or even traveling within the U.S., if you've been to one of those hot spots, I know from talking to somebody that did take a trip to one of those areas, they really, you know, it's a process. Like, they're really checking you out. Maybe they did with this gentleman too, I don't know. I shouldn't call him a gentleman, he's a terrorist. But I just wonder how easy was it to get back in. It seems like it shouldn't be easy. Maybe it wasn't. I'm not sure of the process. Did you guys see any details about that? Has that come out at all?
I didn't see anything about the vetting process. I think he probably went through any kind of normal vetting process, but I didn't see any details about that. Just that MI5 had their eye on him. They knew what he was up to, but they didn't have any probable cause to arrest him.
Right.
Like, they didn't have enough legal weight to arrest him for anything.
But that's always where the hands are tied, right? Can't do anything until they do something. But once they do something, it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
That's where it kind of sits.
Yeah, and like Abraham was saying, it does seem to open the door for tyranny when just because you suspect someone of something, you can detain them or arrest them for a long period of time. But maybe just a very short detainment just to check the guy out more thoroughly would be fair. I mean, if people are going to do things that get themselves put on a watch list in the first place, maybe a few hours of inconvenience would be worth potentially saving lives. They could probably find out a lot about a person in a few hours and then hopefully even prevent some of these things. There has to be something changed. There has to be some sort of a compromise, although obviously you don't want the government taking advantage of that somehow.
Right. In my experience of flying, again, maybe it's changed somewhat since the last time I've flown, but typically if they were going to pull random people out of line, they'd usually pull me out, you know, middle-aged white male, pretty safe to pull me out. I think they did it on purpose because they didn't want to offend anybody else, because there are plenty of times where I was in line with people that would probably be coming from some of those areas that you might want to look at, but I was always the one pulled out, and it was fine. I went on my way. It wasn't a big deal, but I always just thought, well, are you really checking stuff out, or are you just trying to not offend anyone? And that's the dicey thing, too, trying not to offend people, but at the same time, trying to be tough on terrorism. You can't do both.
That does show the impact of political correctness, even on national security, because that's a pretty recent development. Even my own father, whenever he would grow out his beard, he's already more tan, a lot more tan skin than me in the first place. And so whenever he grows out a beard, he can kind of look like he's from maybe a Middle Eastern country. And so he was profiled quite a lot just to make sure that he wasn't up to no good or something like that. So they were judging based on looks not too long ago. Maybe that was about 15 years ago. Hmm. And my dad had no problem with it because he wasn't doing anything wrong.
Sure.
Yeah. So if people are not hypersensitive, some measures can be taken for safety.
Yeah. And it is tough, though, traveling these days. I mean, you get that one rogue like agent that's taking it too far.
Right.
Typically it'll be okay, but it is interesting. So with this write up here from the Daily Mail with Katie Hopkins, is she looking at it from the standpoint of, hey, government, you need to do something to protect our kids, which in a sense they do. Is she looking at all at the families in the UK and what they're doing, just say on that level, or is she just looking at a purely protect us from terrorism?
In this specific instance, she is mainly just targeting the fact that government buildings are surrounded by extra security right now, and yet there wasn't extra security around this big event that got blown up, basically.
Right.
That's really what she is pointing out, the fact that these people who are almost like rolling out the welcome mat for terrorists are telling everyone else that it's business as usual, that they carry on as normal, that they are stronger if they don't get divided over something like this. She's pretty much pointing out, this is like a Russian propaganda effort. This is like Soviet-style propaganda. It's there's no truth in it. It's not that anyone's stronger after an attack like this. Right. There has to be some action taken, but really there hasn't been much in Britain. They've tried to coexist with a rival civilization living in their midst.
Yeah, and so her frustration is that those in the government, they're going to have plenty of protection, but the rest of you just carry on and it'll be fine.
Right.
But if they really thought it was going to be fine, they wouldn't be loading up the protection on their facilities.
Exactly. It does sort of show that maybe the leaders are worried, but the words that they are putting out are not conveying maybe the level of urgency needed to deal with a problem like this. And that is, it's very frustrating to her. And there have been instances where the BBC created a video of people saying they're not even angry. That is propaganda. How could someone not be emotionally impacted by a terrorist attack?
Yeah, if you're not angry, that would be a good question to ask yourself. Well, why not?
Right.
You're justified in being very angry about that.
That's almost like ultimate narcissism, only caring about oneself.
Yeah, I'm fine, so I'll carry on. Yeah.
Yeah, she brings up a good point, though, the author, just how in times of crisis, people want honesty. And this reminds me of during the Blitz in London in World War II, Churchill and the government had more protection than the average Londoner. The people in London, they had their own shelter. They could go to the subway or they get cover the best they could. Hundreds died during the Blitz. But they knew Churchill cared about them because he would go out and risk his own life seeing them and visiting them. But also he told them the truth. When he spoke to them in public on the radio, he told them what was going on. He said, we could lose. We're probably going to get invaded, but we're going to fight on. It's that kind of sentiment that Britain needs right now. Just a leader, not to give them a bunch of nice-sounding parables and phrases to smooth everything over. They need someone just to tell them the truth and to tell them how hard things are going to be. And then people will move on with life and accept that it is going to be hard, but at least we're doing something about it. And there's a disconnect between the trust in the politician and the people, and you only can do that if you're honest.
Well, yeah, well, and if you look at Churchill's example there, his message was denied until people's backs were against the wall.
Yeah.
It was too, you know, where they knew there was no other, where this is happening. And I don't think, see, the UK is not at that point yet. I mean, people think, they think they maybe will carry on somehow and it'll be okay. And they're not to that point where they realize this is, there's imminent danger for them. And so, you know, if somebody came out and told them the truth, I'm sure they'd be, it wouldn't be well received yet, because it means changing some things, and that's the uncomfortable part for the citizens.
Well, that's just another example of how leaders are merely a reflection of the people. Maybe some people are finally getting upset and saying this needs to stop right now, but for the last couple decades, that hasn't been the message, and so the politicians do not want to put out there that they are at war, or else maybe they would not be approved, maybe they would not win the next election. So it's just a matter of the politicians trying to appease the people, but right now maybe it's not working. Maybe people are finally waking up to what's going on.
It'll be interesting next couple of weeks and months ahead to see what happens there. There is some anger, as Grant, you bring out from this this piece from the Daily Mail from Katie Hopkins. What does that translate to? We'll find out as we go forward. But a lot of great information about that, what happened there on the Trump Daily from a day ago. Make sure you check that out. They're right there on the ground, so they're right where that's happening. Today is a big day for Star Wars fans, which there are a lot of Star Wars fans. Grant, I have to tell the audience, you have claimed, and I believe this to be true, you have not seen a single Star Wars movie. Is that true?
I don't know how it's possible, but it is true.
Wow.
I've never tried to avoid Star Wars movies, but it's just how it played out somehow.
I wonder how many of those people there are. You're in a special club.
Probably people would be intentionally avoiding them if there is anyone else. I can't imagine that somehow anyone else has missed, what is it, all 8 of them now?
So at this point, I mean, you've got a pretty good streak going. You know, there's pressure to, like, never watch them now.
I actually feel like I need to get around to maybe watching them, because even the last 2 that came out in theaters, I had good intentions of going, and it just never happened somehow.
Just didn't do it.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I saw the originals when I was a kid, and then didn't think much of it, but then they came back out. And then when you have kids, it kind of pulls you back in a little bit. They're interesting stories. Obviously, there's going to be a little bit of controversy over some of it, but today is the 40th anniversary of Star Wars, and Abraham, you wanted to talk about Star Wars and about how it can actually distort how we view real history. Yeah, that's a real joy kill for the Star Wars fans out there.
Yeah.
They wanted a history segment on Star Wars.
Maybe I can do that another time. But yeah, 40 years ago today, A New Hope, which is now the Old Hope, came out, and it started this phenomenon of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And it's been going on for 40 years constantly, basically, without interruption. And what's interesting, though, is especially with the last 2 ones that come out, there's obviously become very politicized, much more so than the old movies under George Lucas. They were just a space opera. They weren't meant to really convey any societal values. They're just about a battle of good versus evil. But I think after going through it all, and other people have read and spoken about this, but that Star Wars, it's the battle is between a rebellion against an evil empire. And the subtext to all the movies is that empire is evil and should be overthrown. And that kind of message is actually what was very popular in America in the 70s, the 80s, and to today. That empire is a very negative thing, that any powerful entity in the real world or in science fiction is something that should be overthrown because it's going to be naturally evil.
Yeah. I'm not into the stories well enough to know, and some people really, really know all about it. I'm always confused as to like who's who's good, who's bad. It keeps changing, and it seems like to me, and so I've never followed it that closely. But the Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader, they're the like because originally, right, that whole idea was that it was sort of a regular government, but it got corrupted and taken over by a dictator. People didn't realize who it was, etc.
Yeah,
and this rebellion fights back. That's the gist. Sorry to ruin it. Spoiler alert.
I actually did pick up on that sort of anti-government message even without watching any of them.
Yeah.
I mean, sure, maybe in this case, the Empire does seem pretty bad.
Yeah.
There's a couple characters on the dark side who it's kind of hard to justify what they're doing. But if you do start to think after watching a movie like that, that, say, the British Empire was a horrible thing, that's maybe not the right lesson to come away with.
Well, right, and they always in the movies make one character so evil that, you know, yes, clearly you want them destroyed, but even in this movie world, you know, if the rebellion wins, well, what would stop them from being corrupted? You know, it's the same question, I guess, but yeah, if you look at the theme of a lot of those, it is rebellion, but they make the Empire look so bad that you kind of let along on this story. Like, well, of course you'd have to rebel against that.
Yeah, I mean, in the movie, the Empire is evil. I'm not making the case that it's the Empire is good and the rebellion is bad.
That's at Abraham Blondeau on Twitter, if anyone wants to respond.
Yeah, no, if anyone has their own theories about Star Wars, just please send them to me because I'd love to see what you think.
We might be inflaming more emotion during this segment than during most.
That's true. Terrorism, yeah, it's a bad deal. Now, what did he say about Star Wars?
Yeah, I'll be offending all the fans, the whole army of Star Wars fans here.
You'll have stormtroopers on your door.
Yeah, I've actually met a couple stormtroopers and Darth Vader. I had a friend growing up who was obsessed with Star Wars, and I came over to his house one day, and I went down to his basement where his room is, and there was Darth Vader standing there, and it was my friend. He bought, like, a Darth Vader costume and had, like, the blinking lights, lightsaber, everything.
And he dressed up knowing you were coming.
Yeah.
That was, like, the big thing.
Yeah.
Wow. I've seen him at the mall. Sometimes they'll bring him around so the kids can, you know, it's always exciting for them. But it is, yeah, it's interesting. There is, I mean, you look at any of those stories that are very popular, and you can always... I don't know what the author was thinking exactly, but you can always see, I think that they do try to go back to the Bible in some way, and then they just sort of manipulate the what happens, you know, the redemption of a bad person, they become a good person, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems like no matter what people try to do, what story they try to come up with, you kind of have to go back to that because it has everything in it as far as like drama and power and good versus evil and all of that. They're always going back to it in some way, but then, of course, manipulating it.
Definitely some captivating stories. You were saying the last two, Abraham, are more politicized, you think? Do you know, like, how exactly would that be? Because I obviously haven't seen them.
Well, the biggest way is that they're more female leads. Mm. There's more diversity in the characters. And then there's also... In the homosexual lobby group in Hollywood, they want there to be a homosexual couple in the next Star Wars movie.
So that these are kids' movies, really. At the end of the day,
yeah.
So it's propaganda in that way.
Yeah, exactly. So Star Wars is actually becoming a platform for a political discussion instead of just being a space opera. But the thing that really got me from space opera. That's what it is. That's
the name called. Of your band in college.
Yeah,
space opera.
That's after
You've had
the
so many college bands.
I know that's after they keep folding up one by one. But what was interesting, I was thinking about Star Wars and all this, and that if you look at it, a lot of the events in Star Wars actually mirror the history of the British Empire, and that is, I was like, oh, there's no way that a bunch of rabble could beat off like an Imperial army, fully like trained. They're coordinated. There's no way they could beat them off. And then I wrote an article about the American Revolution. I'm like, well, that actually happened.
It did.
Because Americans beat off the British in a very similar fashion to the rebellion, just not without spaceships. And then I was also thinking about the Death Star exploding. I'm like, well, there's no event in history where there's this single weakness that the enemy exploited in defeating the Empire. I'm like, oh, wait, there actually was one. The Battle of Jutland. The British battleships had a malfunction that if you hit them in the central turret, they would explode because it would cause a chain reaction going down to where they stored all their explosives.
Mm-hmm.
So that actually happened. And I'm like, wow. I don't think George Lucas, when he wrote them, had this in mind necessarily, but if you look at history, there are some examples of Imperial overstretch of empires crumbling in a very similar fashion as there is in Star Wars. And the only reason I bring it up, I don't want to get into the subtext or full thing, but just that a lot of children watch Star Wars and their first impression is that all government needs to be overthrown. Rebels are people that need to be idolized, and that empires are inherently evil. That's kind of the message most kids get, I think, when they watch it, because they don't know. They boil it down to very basic things. They don't understand maybe how it relates to the real world. And I think that's an attitude you can pick up in a lot of young people. And it's not just Star Wars, other movies too, but where the government, the empire is always evil and needs to be overthrown, whether that's the British Empire or the American government or whatever it might be.
Yeah, even in the one of the more recent ones, I think I think it was the Empire still. I don't know who's who half the time. But they had the one scene where it clearly was trying to depict the Nazis in a way.
Yeah.
Because they were all basically doing the Nazi salute, and the flags look sort of like the Nazi flags. I mean, everybody picked up on that. So they're really trying to draw on some of these really evil powers in history and then incorporate it into these movies. But again, it's not the fact that some empires are bad, but some are good. But there is that idea, like you say, that all empire is bad. And even there was even this rock group in the 90s that was very political. And they had one particular album, I think it was called Evil Empire. And it kind of looked like a combination of something you'd see in Star Wars, but it was obviously a shot at the United States. Mm. And so the music built on that and all of it. And so it does kind of factor into that, just the thinking that you get from some of those movies, that there's this great evil empire. And sometimes the U.S. is looked at that way, which is crazy, or the British Empire.
Yeah, exactly. And that's kind of the interesting message these movies convey. And 40 years ago, that wasn't. I don't think that was the goal of it or anything George Lucas had in mind, although he was a product of that society of the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s, which are very anti-government in many ways. I don't know. I don't want to put him in a particular camp, but that could be a possibility. But in any event, today, if we look at 40 years later with Star Wars, there's very clear messages in the movies now that there weren't there 40 years ago when it was just a more lighthearted, where you have this huge walking bear or dog with Chewbacca, and people just like the banter, and it's cool. Like, you have spaceships and they look cool and these battles, but now it's about representing women, making women look more powerful than men. It's all about having a homosexual couple in a Disney movie, which will either happen in Star Wars or in Marvel. They're not sure which one will happen first. You have all these different things coming about to where Star Wars 40 years later is changing so much to where it's not really what it used to be. And yeah. I think it's kind of sad that it's just becoming a platform for progressive, and it's going to ruin like kind of its legacy maybe.
Well, it's a reflection of the society. If you want to sell a movie and you want to make it hip to the current generation, you've got to go the way that the generation's going, which is these movies are darker. Because if you do go back and you look at the originals, it wouldn't probably sell today. People would be like, that's cheesy, you know. But it was a little funner, probably more fun back then. But now it's getting darker, and it is more political, like you say. So it is interesting because in a way the stories are kind of neat and kids get excited about it. But then you do have to sometimes evaluate, well, what exactly is the message that we're getting here? Because I think there is some thought coming, a lot of thought probably coming from Hollywood about putting a message in there, like you said.
Yeah, especially more so today, and that's something to be on guard against, I think. But, I mean, I've seen every Star Wars movie, and the old ones are still my favorite. But they do have imagination and stuff in them, but there's always some kind of danger to them, because if you're just allowing a movie or something to instruct you on something you should be instructed from somewhere else, then that's a big problem.
Yeah, that's always a challenge in parenting. There's always a new trend or a new fad or a new movie or something that they really kids get excited about because they're marketed very well. Because they know the kids are going to go, and they're not paying for themselves, but mom and dad are, and then they can sell you, you know, the Darth Vader helmet full of popcorn or whatever. I don't know if they do that. That'd be a great idea, though. Lightsaber full of candy, jelly bellies. and so they're going to definitely make it appeal to kids. But again, what about the messages these days? And I suppose that's probably always been the case. You know, you can think back to years ago and the things that people were upset about, probably rightfully so, but they seem tame today. You know, rock and roll and things like that. But it does influence people. It has a huge influence on people. The entertainment industry does. And so there should be a responsibility there to be putting the right message out there. But I think it's pretty clear that Hollywood's message is not in line with what many parents would hope for.
Yeah, if you think about today, what could children come away from a Star Wars movie possibly thinking if their parents aren't diligent? They could think that the people riding in the street with the black mask over their face are the good guys just because they're rebels. So it is important to point out that not all rebellion's a good thing, and maybe not all empires a good thing either, but certainly a lot of empires have been good.
Yeah. So 40 years of history there with Star Wars, and Grant's going to watch them all tonight. They'll have more insight for us tomorrow.
Eventually.
Eventually. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us here on this Thursday edition of Trumpet Radio Live, Kia David program, Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Coming up in a bit, for myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turge, and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Thursday, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.